cultivate our motivation together. And for a moment, stop and experience yourself as one living being among countless living beings. And be aware of how all of us living beings are interrelated, dependent on each other, influencing and affecting each other all the time. And since that's the case, make an aspiration that all the interactions you have with other living beings, may they be free of harm, so that anything you think or feel, say or do is free of any harmful intention towards others or towards yourself. And make an aspiration that all these interactions, may everything you do be of long-term and short-term benefit for other living beings. So that the purpose of your life is not simply your own pleasure, but it's to help bring happiness to others and free others from difficulties and problems. In other words, the meaning and purpose of your life and the thing that gives you the greatest pleasure, aspire, may this be being of benefit to other living beings, no matter who they are. And in order to be of the greatest benefit, we need to purify our own mind, develop spiritual realizations, in short, attain full awakening, so that we can be of the most effective benefit. And so generate that aspiration for full awakening, motivated by love and compassion for other living beings. May this be the reason for us gathering together this evening and sharing the Buddhist teachings. So generating that motivation together is a very important part of what we're doing. And whenever I give Dharma talks at the beginning, you know, I always have some silent meditation and I generate certain aspirations. And one of them is always, you know, may we share the same motivation to be of great benefit to living beings and attain awakening for that purpose. And whenever I think that is, you know, part of our, you know, our being together, it really makes my mind quite happy. Because when you think about it, we're always together with groups of people. But what kind of motivation do we usually have for the being together with certain groups of people. You know, you go to work. What is the common motivation for being at your workplace? Is there a common motivation that people are all working towards? You know? Or is it, you know, is it to make money? Is it to forward the success of the business? You know, what's the common motivation? When you go to a football game or a baseball game, yeah, what's the common motivation that people have? Yeah, when you go to a concert, a rock concert, yeah, or you go to a dance, or you go to a dinner, what's the motivation that people have, you know? Is there something, common motivation that bring them all together for the same purpose? And when you really think about it, it's not so often in our lives that we have the opportunity to be with a group of people where our common motivation is to improve ourselves so we can be of greater and greater benefit to other living beings. Yeah. Mostly, our motivations in our life are, how can I have happiness? How can I be famous? How can I be successful? How can, you know, I? Yeah. But to share a common motivation with people where we're all working for a very noble spiritual aim, that opportunity doesn't come so often, and it's really rather precious to be together with a group of people that share that. When I went to college, I started the autumn of 67. So this was the time O.J. Simpson was at USC. I did my first 2 years at SC, and then I transferred to UCLA. So we went to football games. I only went because I don't understand football. I don't like football. But there was a guy I like who asked me to go, so I went. Just to be with him, not, you know. But anyway, O.J. was playing. Yeah? And you know what we used to shout? Well, I didn't shout it, but in the bleachers, all the USC fans, what everybody shouted to O.J.? Kill! Kill! Yeah, because he was what was he? Was he a quarterback or a linebacker? I don't know. He was some big guy. I don't understand football, but you guys. But anyway, so he was supposed to kill the enemy of the other team, the opponent of the other team. Of course, that put other imprints about killing in his mind that didn't turn out so well, did it? But the common motivation in that football stadium, at least from the, you know, it was a home game, so it was mostly USC fans, was always, you know, we're going to win and we're going to clobber them. And that's the common motivation. Yeah. And it's like, do you want to spend your life being around other people in a common place where that's the motivation? Yeah. What does that do to your own heart? What does that do to how you want to live and your values and who you are in the world? Yeah. So it is quite different, you know, coming here, and we have a very different group motivation, and we deliberately cultivate it together so that we're all together doing something. I think that's quite powerful in this world. And I think especially in these chaotic times, having a group of people who generate a motivation like this together is quite powerful. I would love to go give a Dharma talk in Congress. Yeah? Could you imagine that? His Holiness went several years ago, and he gave a 15-minute talk. And I think in the Senate, and I was thinking, wow, Mitch McConnell, the whole heard His Holiness, and Ted Cruz, they heard His Holiness, how fortunate these people were. But of course, who knows what their motivation was, but some seed was planted. Yeah. And because the feeling in our government is, anything but bodhicitta nowadays, anything but compassion. And so I think it's powerful when a group of people meet together for this kind of purpose. Okay? Because it also shows something in each of us, some appreciation for virtue, some inclination towards kindness, towards compassion, that we have that kind of value in our lives. So quite important. So tonight, we're supposed to talk about samsara, nirvana, and Buddha nature. So this is an unpaid public announcement. There's a book by that title. And that's how the talk got the title, because of the book. So the book is volume 3 in a series. His Holiness Dalai Lama is the chief author, and I'm the assistant. The series is called The Library of Wisdom and Compassion, and it's going to be, His Holiness's major English language work. So this is volume 3. It just came out in January. So, what did we say? Hot off the press. Whatever it is. Okay. So volume 1 is Approaching the Buddhist Path. And that's kind of an introductory volume covering a lot of different topics. Volume 2 was The Foundation of Buddhist Practice. And that also has a lot of introductory material, but also starts getting into really the practice. And by the way, introductory material does not mean easy material. Yeah, we usually the introduction, that's the easy stuff for some, I'm an advanced person. I don't need the introductory stuff. Actually, the introductory stuff is not so easy when you really think about it. Especially the way His Holiness teaches, because he just jumps in, and he, especially when he teaches in the West, he knows it's an educated audience who are not coming just out of faith, but they're people who are going to ask questions and think about what he says, and so he just tells it to you, the deep stuff right off the bat. Okay, volume 3 is this one, Samsara, Nirvana, and Buddha Nature. Volume 4 is with the publisher now. It'll come out in October. And it's called Following in the Buddha's Footsteps. Volume 5, I've just been working on. And it's called In Praise of Great Compassion. And then there will be several more volumes after that. But volume 3, this one, is quite precious. They did a lovely job, didn't they? I really like the cover. The cover, if you see, it looks like a monster. This is the Lord of Death. And what he's clutching in his hands is called the Wheel of Life. And the Wheel of Life talks about the different realms, the different states of being where living beings can be born. And I wanted them to really emphasize that. This is why we only have part of the Wheel of Life in here. there's the Buddha in one corner, and he is pointing to the moon over here. Okay? He's gesturing. And what that symbolizes is, you know, here's the wheel of life, the wheel of confusion, the wheel of ignorance. And the Buddha is pointing to the way out. He's showing us the path to follow, yeah, which is quite powerful. So we have to know what the wheel of life is about. That's samsara. Samsara is the constantly, the repetitively cycle of being born again and again and again under the control of ignorance and karma, karma being our actions. Yeah, and so fueled by ignorance, you know, pushed by the imprints of our previous actions that we've done, then at the time of death of one body, our mind craves another existence. We get born in another body, you know, experience results, create new causes, die, you know, again get reborn. And so it all occurs under the influence of ignorance. I think there's a perfume named Samsara. This isn't. This is a different one. They plagiarized this name. Okay. That nirvana is the state free from samsara. I think there's a band called Nirvana. They, again, plagiarized the Buddha term. Okay. I guess you go from perfume to rock music. But, you know, nirvana is the state free from this repeated rebirth that is under the control of ignorance and mental afflictions and our previous actions. Okay. So we're in samsara now. We want to get to nirvana, but nirvana's not a place. Okay. So you can't turn on your GPS and write. Although my friend told me there was, where was he? Some state in the Midwest. They went through a town called Nirvana. But, you know, it's not, Nirvana's not, you know, three clouds up and two clouds to the left or something like this. It's a state of mind. It's not a place. It's a mental state. Yeah? So we don't go there by external transportation. We go there by internal transformation. And what allows us to go from samsara to nirvana, these different mental states, is the fact that we have the Buddha nature. Okay. So Buddha nature means that there's some pure element of our mind that makes it possible to get rid of ignorance, purify the mind completely, stop the polluted karma, and find an actual state of peace and bliss. So I thought this evening to talk a little bit about, you know, why, there's one chapter in here called Why Liberation is Possible. There's a couple of chapters about Buddha nature. So I thought to talk more about that because I think it's quite important to know what our potential is, what we have going for us right now that will enable us to attain the freedom, the liberation of the state of nirvana. Okay? So when I've been teaching on the different volumes of the book, I like to read a little bit. You know, because then you get a little bit how His Holiness puts things. Okay? So. Okay, so the mind and its potential. So that'll read a little bit. Stop and comment. Read a little bit more. Stop and comment. Okay? So this section is talking about the mind's potential. And like I said, I think that's very important for us to have an idea of, because so often people suffer from a very poor self-image, you know, and people spend a lot of time in self-talk deprecating themselves, putting themselves down, telling themselves they're not good enough. Yeah. I've been reading Michelle Obama's book, yeah, some of you have been too. And she brings this up all throughout the book. Her question to herself is, am I good enough? And I think many people have this, you know, am I good enough? No, I'm not good enough. Other people are better. I have this fault and that fault, and I have this problem and that problem. And that kind of self-talk, self-image, is a huge impediment, not only for our spiritual practice, but also for having a happy life. Because as soon as we start out, you know, with the basic idea of, I'm not good enough, then we're already setting ourselves on a course. We're already directing our lives and our mind in a certain direction. And especially if we have that idea of, I'm not good enough, and we've never questioned, is that idea correct? Is that true? Yeah, we just have that idea because we thought it, we believe it without questioning it. Then we really get stuck. So it's very important to, you know, these things that we think about ourselves or about others, to question, are they true? Yeah. One book I wrote is called Don't Believe Everything You Think. You know? And there's a reason, you know, because a lot of what we think is garbaggio. You know? Yeah, it's plain old rubbish. But we often can't tell rubbish thoughts and emotions from reliable thoughts and emotions. Yeah, our wisdom is lacking. So, you know, whatever idea pops into my mind, I believe it. And I tell you, when you really start watching your mind and tracking your mind, you realize that a lot of what you think is wrong. Yeah? For all sorts of reasons. Last week I noticed I was, you know, some people were supposed to come and do something and they didn't come. And I was getting mad, like, they know this is happening. They know they're supposed to be here. Yeah? They came to lunch. This is right after lunch. Why aren't they here? They know they need to be here. It couldn't be because they're sick, because they were at lunch. They were well enough for lunch, so something that happens a few hours, they're still well. How come they're not here? Nah. We have a rule, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm getting really mad. And then I happen to go and to a building, you know, where one of them's there, and she's in bed because she's sick. And the other one was also sick. And here I am, getting really mad, thinking I had correct information, and I had totally wrong information. Actually, in the last 2 weeks, this has happened to me 3 times. Where I've been getting irritated, and I thought I had correct information. I was sure, and I had wrong information. That simple. Yeah. of just having wrong information. Then, you know, when we start looking at some of our other thoughts and what we make up, you know, I'm not good enough. Look at that thought. What does good enough mean? What's the definition of good enough? Yeah? If you're going to say you're not good enough, then you must have an idea of what good enough means. Do you have an idea of what good enough means? What is your idea of good enough? Yeah? Does it mean you look a certain way? Does it mean you have a certain income? Does it mean you have certain friends? What does good enough mean? According to whose standards? According to what values? Is good enough an external thing? Is good enough an internal thing? Is good enough according to you? Is good enough according to somebody else? But you see, we never ask these questions. We just say, I'm not good enough, and then sign off. And when we think we're not good enough, we're digging ourselves into a ditch. Because when you say you're not good enough, then you're stopping yourself before you even try. I taught grade school before I became a nun. And I had one third grade class. There's a little boy named Tyrone in that class. And somewhere along the line in his 8 or 9 years of life, somebody must have told him he was stupid. I don't know who, I don't know how, because Tyrone had the idea that he could not learn how to read. And because he had that idea, he could not learn how to read. And I knew that idea was totally wrong. Tyrone was not stupid. Yeah, he was a smart kid, but he didn't know it. He didn't think it. And because of having that totally wrong idea, that idea limited him. So in the same way with us, we have all sorts of ideas that limit us. So, when we talk about the mind's potential, try and have an expansive mind and try and enlarge your self-image and enlarge what you think you can do. Okay? So, as sentient beings, beings with minds that are still obscured, we have great potential. Our greatest potential being to become fully awakened Buddhas, omniscient beings who have wisdom, compassion, power, and skillful means to be of the greatest benefit to all. Do you believe you have that potential? In your heart, do you believe that you have that potential? Or in your heart, do you just say, I'm just little old me. Oh, please be nice to me. Don't criticize me. Don't hurt my feelings. Yeah? Do you have a feeling like you could become, you know, a being who's completely wise and compassionate, fearless, who has no anger, so that anybody can call you any name and it doesn't affect you at all? Do you feel like you have that potential inside? We have that potential. Are we aware of it? Yeah. You have the potential. So no matter what the president tweets, you don't care. Even if the content of the tweet is about you. Yeah. It doesn't affect you at all. Wouldn't that be nice? Okay. A natural quality of mind is its ability to cognize objects. This capacity to be aware of and to know objects is already present. It does not have to be newly cultivated. It's the nature of the mind. Nevertheless, various obstructions can inhibit the mind from cognizing objects. When these are eliminated, the mind will have no difficulty knowing all phenomena. So the very nature of the mind is to know objects. And the only reason our mind doesn't know certain things is because there's some obscuration or obstruction along the way. Yeah, that's the only reason. You get rid of the obstructions and then the mind, by its very nature, will know things. So now his holiness is going to talk about the different kinds of obstructions. One type of obstruction is physical matter. A wall obstructs us from seeing what is beyond it. When the wall is removed, our visual consciousness can see what is there. Makes sense. We can't see the parking lot, but you take away the wall, you open the door, we can see it. Okay. A second obstruction is distance and size. The object is too far away or too small for our cognitive faculties to come in contact with it. To some extent, telescopes and microscopes have helped alleviate this difficulty. In those cases, we can know the object not because the mind has become clearer and better able to apprehend the object, but because the object is brought within the range of our operable cognitive faculties. Okay? So we can't see bacteria, but if they're enlarged, we can see them. We can't see, I don't know, there's, you know, lots of stars and planets and stuff out there. You use a telescope, then we can see that. So it's distance. Yeah. A third, so these are, you know, things we can know that are obstructions that can be overcome. Yeah. A third difficulty concerns the cognitive faculties that are the bases of consciousness. The visual consciousness is able to perceive only visual forms, not sounds or other sense phenomena, because it is dependent on the eye faculty. If a healthy eye faculty is absent, the visual consciousness cannot perceive visual forms. Okay, so if we don't have a healthy eye faculty, you know, ear, anything, those things aren't functioning, we can't cognize the objects. Yeah. Within the last 2 years, or a few years, I should say, you know, now I'm wearing glasses, I have hearing aids, you know, your cognitive faculties are like, what did you say? You know, I don't have my glasses, I can't see that. So, you know, you improve your cognitive faculties, the obstructions are eliminated. Okay, I had cataract surgery last summer. By the way, any of you who are considering cataract surgery, it's a breeze, don't worry at all about it. Okay, that's my 2 cents, really. Don't worry at all. Okay. The type of brain a being has also influences what that being can perceive. A mental faculty dependent on an animal brain and one dependent on a human brain have different ranges of objects they can know. Due to the complexity of the brains of these two beings, the mental faculties and consciousnesses depending on them differ in what they can perceive and understand. Okay? So if you have dogs or cats, can they perceive things that you don't? Yeah, they can, can't they? Yeah. On the other hand, our human brain gives us the ability to think about things and to use reason. And animal brains are very limited in that respect. Okay, so the type of brain is quite important. But it's not the only thing. Furthermore, a mind proliferating with wrong views and overwhelmed with disturbing emotions is too distracted and preoccupied to turn its attention to other objects. The range of what such afflictive mental states can know becomes very limited. A calm mind can become more astute. Okay? When you are upset emotionally, do you see things clearly? Come on. Yeah. You think you do, don't you? When you're angry, you think, I'm seeing everything very clearly. I see it perfectly. You are wrong and I am right. That's the situation. Yeah. More garbage. Okay. When we're emotionally upset, we can't see things very clearly. And we can't take in new information. Scientists have a name for it. It's called the refractory period, where you have a very intense emotion. Anything that doesn't agree with your emotion, you can't take in. Yeah, the mind's totally shut down. Do you ever get like that? Yeah? When you're really mad at somebody and you are self-righteous, and then somebody comes and tells you you have the wrong information. Are you open to the fact that maybe you have the wrong information? No, I am right. Or even if it's something more complicated, maybe you have the right information, but you're looking at the information in the wrong way. Okay, somebody tries to tell you that? Yeah, hey, you know, that person who said that, they weren't speaking about you. They weren't criticizing you. Don't take it personally. No, they were criticizing me. I know it. Okay, again, you know, our mind is obscured. This time by inner emotions, inner attitudes. Okay, another type of obscuration is subtle defilements on the mind that produce false appearances. These prevent us from attaining Buddhahood, the state of omniscient mind. When these subtle defilements are removed, the mind will naturally perceive all phenomena. Do you have a feeling that you have false appearances sometimes? That your senses, you know, what you think you're seeing, that does everything really exist the way it appears to you? Yeah, we feel like it does. But when we really start investigating, you know, does everything exist the way it appears? Or do I have some false appearances here? Yeah. For example, yeah, when we look at other people, they look kind of permanent, don't they? Yeah, you look at everybody and it's like, yeah, they're all here and they're going to be here tomorrow and they're going to be here the next day and the day after and day after. And nobody's going to change in any significant ways. And we look and we think that that's a correct appearance because everything looks very stable and predictable and it's permanent, not going to change. But when you think about it, is that the way people are? Are they stable and predictable and not changing? Hardly. Not at all. We're changing in every nanosecond. And what we think changes all the time. And our opinions change. And our emotional states change all the time. And biologically, physiologically, the body is changing all the time. But we have this wrong appearance that everything is stable and predictable. And that's why when things happen that we don't expect, we're so shocked. Yeah? How could that plane go down in Ethiopia? That wasn't on my, you know, how can Boeing make something defective? Impossible. You know? So, So there's something about the way we're thinking and how things appear to us that isn't correct, that we don't always notice that. The main obstruction to omniscience are the latencies of afflictions, the subtle appearance of inherent existence that they produce, and the defilement preventing seeing the two truths simultaneously. After the wisdom realizing ultimate reality eliminates the afflictive obscurations, it must cleanse the cognitive obscurations from the mind. When every last defilement is removed, the mind is totally purified and its excellent qualities are fully developed. This is the state of Buddhahood, in which the capabilities of the mind have no limits. The effectiveness of a Buddha's activities depends not on the abilities of that Buddha, but on the receptivity of sentient beings. Okay? So what he's saying here is our minds have two sets of internal spiritual obscurations. One is called the afflictive obscurations. So these are disturbing emotions and wrong views. Things like ignorance, anger, clinging attachment, jealousy, pride, wrong, you know, different kinds of wrong views. And then cognitive obscurations, which are the latencies, the residual energy left over, even if afflictive ones are eliminated. But when we're able to see reality, when we're able to see, to know false appearances are false, and to understand how things actually exist, their deeper way of existence. Yeah, when our mind becomes familiar with that, again and again and again, it overcomes all those different kinds of obscurations. When those obscurations are eliminated, then by the very nature of the mind, it can reflect and cognize all objects. So we all have that potential. So telling ourselves I'm not good enough is nonsense, isn't it? When we have that potential to become fully awakened and to know reality, sitting there and saying, oh, but you know, I can't do this. Poor me, you know, it's rubbish. Okay. The next section is called, Is Liberation Possible? Okay, so I won't read the whole thing. I'll just touch on some of the main points that His Holiness brings up here. Okay? Because if we're going to aim for liberation, or nirvana, that state of ultimate freedom, we need to know that it's possible to attain it. So the first reason is the basic or true nature of the mind is pure. Okay. Actually, I'll read this little bit. It's quite nice. The basic nature of the mind is clear like water. Dirt in a glass of water isn't the nature of the water and can be removed. No matter how murky the water may be, its essential quality of clarity is never lost. Okay, so in the same way, you know, even the conventional nature of our mind, its basic quality is to reflect and to know objects. Yeah. There's dirt on our mind in the sense of afflictions, ignorance, clinging attachment, and anger being the principal ones, but there's tons of other ones. Okay? But the basic nature of the mind is pure. So it's like the glass of water with dirt in it. When you look at it, you say it's a dirty glass, it's full of dirty water. But if you let it sit there, the water will, the mud will settle. And then, you know, further impurities, you constrain it, put it through an osmosis filter or something. You constrain it, get all the impurities out. So the basic nature of the water is pure. Yeah. The dirt is some extra added thing that is not the nature of the water. So it's like that in our mind. All the things about ourselves that we don't feel comfortable with, or our bad temper, our depression, our, you know, out of control, greed, whatever it is, all those things are not the basic nature of our mind. Okay? The basic nature of the mind is pure. And another analogy that's used is the basic nature of the sky. Okay? The sky is open everywhere, isn't it? Yeah. In Seattle especially, not every day, you can't see the sky. You know, there's often clouds. Yeah. But if you catch a good weekend in the summer, you can have a cloudless sky. So even when the clouds are there, the nature of the sky is always open. The sky hasn't lost its nature of pure open space. It's just obscured, we can't see it. So it's that way with the nature of the mind. The nature of the mind is pure. It's just obscured. Okay? So the nature of the mind is pure. The second point is the afflictions are adventitious. Adventitious means they're not part of the nature of the mind. Okay? So, yes, everybody here get angry from time to time? Yeah? We all get angry. Yeah? We're with friends, we can admit it. Do you get jealous sometimes? Do you get arrogant? Do you get greedy? Yeah? We all have the same things, okay? But these things are not the nature of the mind. They are adventitious. So even though they may be there, yeah, they aren't embedded in the nature of the mind. Okay? If fire is hot, you can't take the heat out of fire and still have fire. Because the nature of the fire is hot. But you can still have the mind and take out all these afflictive mental states. Because they aren't embedded in the nature of the mind. The third reason His Holiness goes into is that it's possible to cultivate very powerful antidotes that eliminate these disturbing emotions and wrong views and obscurations. Okay? Now why? Why is it possible to eliminate these? Yeah. So, I was saying before that ignorance, not knowing the real nature, how things exist, this is the fundamental thing that is the source of all the other wrong views and disturbing emotions and so on. If ignorance were the nature of the mind, then we couldn't eliminate it because it's the nature of the mind. Ignorance is not the nature of the mind. Why? Because ignorance is an erroneous mental state. Ignorance does not perceive things correctly. It perceives things incorrectly. Okay? The thing with us is we've had ignorance alongside our mind stream beginninglessly. We're so familiar with the ignorant view that we don't even realize that it's ignorance. Okay. I often use the example of imagine that you were born with sunglasses. Okay, you came out of the womb wearing sunglasses. Everything you see is tinted. But because you've always had sunglasses, you've never been without sunglasses, you don't even realize that you're not perceiving things the way they are. You think what you're perceiving is reality. simply because it's always been there. So it's the same way with our mind. You know, ignorance has been there. And so we just assume what we're perceiving is correct, but it's not. Why isn't it correct? When we look at things, things appear to us to have their own nature. Yeah? This is Venerable Chendi. This is Venerable Damcha. This is Mary Grace. This is Jordan. This is Barbara. This is Julie. Everybody, this is who they are, as if they had their own nature that makes them who they are. This is carpet. Yeah, this is a building. That is a ceiling. Everything looks like it has its own nature, independent of other factors. You know, when we see things, do we think that they were caused? When we come in the building, do you think, oh, this building exists because the causes for the building exist? When you think of yourself, do you think, I exist because the causes for me exist? Yeah? No, we don't think that. I am here. That's the beginning and end of it. You know? It's not, oh, I exist because, you know, I'm an accumulated, all these different causes happened. We don't see ourselves as an accumulation of parts. We think we're some independent entity, and everything we see is some independent entity. But when we start to analyze, we see that actually things are not independent entities. Everything exists dependent on other factors. Okay. Everything we look at here around us exists because of causes and conditions, right? Yeah. Karma depends on causes and conditions. Yeah. Every person here depends on causes and conditions. Yeah. Everything has parts. It depends on parts. Okay. Everything even depends on the mind perceiving it. If there weren't a mind perceiving something, there's no way to even establish it as existing. Okay. So ignorance perceives things as existing independent of all other factors, when in fact things exist dependent on a whole multiplicity of factors. Okay? So because what ignorance perceives is incorrect, when we generate wisdom that perceives things as they really exist, as dependent, as empty of independent existence, then that wisdom has the capability of overpowering the ignorance. And when we meditate with wisdom over a long period of time and become very habituated with it, it can eliminate every last trace of ignorance completely from the mind stream. So that antidote, that powerful antidote against the ignorance, yeah, the wisdom, especially the wisdom realizing the ultimate nature, that can, you know, that's the cleaning agent. Yeah? It's the Ajax of the mind, but without chemicals, and, you know. It's not a harsh cleaning agent. It's a very gentle one. But, you know, those kind of antidotes exist. And because the nature of the mind is pure, because the afflictions are not embedded in the nature of the mind, then these antidotes can clear away all the obscurations. Sounds good, huh? Yeah? So whenever you sit and tell yourself, oh, I can't do anything right. Oh, I'm such an angry person. That's just my nature. There's nothing I can do about my anger. I make so many mistakes. I'm always making this mistake and that mistake. All those things you tell yourself are big fat lies. Okay? So we have to recognize that now and see at least what our potential is. And when we have confidence that that potential's there, then we can start developing the antidote that is going to free us from these very obscurations. Okay? Another section here is this holiness then goes on to talk about how excellent qualities can be cultivated limitlessly. So that means whatever good qualities we have the seeds for, and we all have seeds for good qualities, these good qualities can be developed limitlessly. Okay, why? There's, again, some reasons. Buddhism is very based on reasons, okay? It's not just believe, it's, okay, we say something and here's why. Okay, so the first reason why excellent qualities can be gained, can be cultivated limitlessly, is the clear and cognizant nature of the mind is a stable basis for the cultivation of excellent qualities. Okay? So the nature, the mind is that which is clear and cognizant. Clear meaning it's formless and it has the ability to reflect objects. Cognizant meaning it can engage with objects. Okay? So the mind is a continuum. Yeah? One moment of mind following another moment of mind. One moment of clarity and cognizance following another moment. And there's nothing that can stop it. There's nothing that can make the mind go out of existence. There's things that can make ignorance, anger, and attachment go out of existence. But there's nothing that can stop the continuity of the mind. Okay? So that very continuity of the mind, because it's one moment after the other, makes a very stable basis upon which good qualities can be developed. Our body, on the other hand, is not a stable basis for developing good qualities. Because our body gets old and sick and dies. You know, and when we die, you know, brain, forget it. It's gone. It gets recycled. Yeah, the worms have dessert. But the mind, the continuity of the mind goes on. And nothing can stop it. So it forms this stable basis. So that's the beginning, the first reason. Why? Because we have the stable basis, then we can develop good qualities endlessly. Second reason is the mind can be habituated to excellent qualities that can be built up cumulatively. So the idea here is, let me read this part from His Holiness. It's quite nice. Excellent mental qualities can be built up gradually without having to begin anew each time we focus on developing them. A high jumper cannot develop his or her ability limitlessly. Each time the bar is raised, the high jumper must cover the same distance that they covered before, plus some. Okay? And so because when you're high jumping, you have to cover the same distance and then add some, your body doesn't have the ability to jump high limitlessly, does it? Because each time you have to already go over what you've done, plus add something. Okay? Yeah, but the nature of the mind is different. The energy from cultivating a quality one day remains, So that if that same quality is cultivated the next day, it builds on what was previously accomplished without having to reestablish it. Okay. So if we have a consistent meditation practice, and let's say you meditate on love one day. Love is the wish for living beings to have happiness and its causes. So it's not the love you hear about on the radio and in movies. This is the kind of love that can be extended to all living beings. Just wishing them well. May they have happiness and its causes. Okay? So if we meditate on that every day, by the power of habituation, that quality can be developed in us. And developed, and it developed. And each time we meditate on love and develop that mind, it becomes stronger and more potent. Okay? So the power of habituation. So it's not like the high jumper, where the high jumper, you know, the bar is here, and then you raise it, you have to do what you did before plus some. No, here, we meditate on love one day, so there's some familiarity. If we keep that up, and the next day do the same meditation, and the next day, and the next day, then it just keeps going up. We don't have to start at the bottom and bring it up each day, okay? So that quality can get developed limitlessly. And then the third reason is excellent qualities can be enhanced but never diminished by reasoning and wisdom. Okay? So all the good qualities are supported by reasoning, they're supported by wisdom. Yeah. The afflictive mental states, like ignorance, like anger, like clinging attachment, these minds are erroneous. They don't apprehend their objects correctly. And so, because of that, when you apply reasoning, when you apply wisdom, these erroneous afflictive emotions and wrong views can be overcome. When we look at our virtuous mental qualities, reasoning and wisdom encourage them and make them grow and can never overcome. It's another reason why it's possible to develop excellent qualities limitlessly. Okay. So these topics, we've covered a lot, yeah? It's something you need to think about. So I recommend listening to the talk again, or get the book, read it again, think about it, yeah? And if you really think deeply about these things, it will change your self-image and how you think about yourself. And when you change how you think about yourself, your whole life changes. Yeah? And the purpose of your life changes. And there's no longer this thing, okay? But you have a real sense of strength and purpose and you know, you go about developing love and compassion and all your good qualities. Yeah, why not? Okay, so we have time for a few questions and maybe some answers or comments if you have any.
Mm-hmm. So what is the nature of mind that it goes on endlessly? Because you have to separate it from the nature of the brain.
Good question. The difference between the brain and the mind. Okay. The brain is physical in nature. Okay? And the scientists can measure it using tools that measure things that are atomic in nature. The mind is not physical in nature. When we say that the mind is that which is clear and cognizant, clear means it's not atomic in nature. It's not physical. Okay? So you can't use any kind of physical means to stop the mind because it's not physical. And it's cognizant, meaning the nature is to perceive things. Yeah? When the gross levels of mind are functioning, they interact with the brain. And we can see that, you know? Sometimes, you know, if something is going on chemically or electrically in your brain, it affects your moods. But it also can go the other way. If you have a certain idea or a mood in your mind, that can affect your brain and your body too. Okay? So there's, with the gross levels of body and mind, they affect each other like that. But they're different natures. When we die, the brain just decomposes into organic matter. Okay? There's no consciousness there. The mind has its own continuum. And the mind is conscious. It knows objects. And then according to our previous actions and our present thoughts, then the mind gets reborn. Okay? But they're different natures. When the mind is in very, very subtle nature, it can exist without the body. Without the body operating. Okay? For example, my precept master who gave me my novice vows, very great master, Kyabje Ling Rinpoche, when he passed away, this was in 1983, yeah, it must have been 83, he sat in meditation for 13 days. The heart had stopped, the breath had stopped, the brain had stopped. But he was still sitting upright. And his mind had gone into a very, very subtle form. And because he was a great meditator, he was meditating on the nature of reality at that time. You know, and so his body was upright. When he finished his meditation and the mind left the body, then the body slumped. Okay? So it's pretty amazing. And this has happened to many people. You know, there's masters who have that kind of realization.
Mm-hmm. Just sort of to follow up on her question, so I was thinking about this distinction between the gross levels of mind and the subtle levels, and would it be fair to say like that the gross levels of mind are affected by things like drugs or alcohol or even the emotions of people in the room, whereas the subtle mind, being formless, isn't affected?
Yeah, when the subtle mind is manifest, the senses are not operable. Yeah? Even sometimes that can happen even when the subtlest mind isn't yet manifest. In deep states of concentration, it's a subtler mind than our senses. It's not the extremely subtle mind, but it's definitely subtler. You know, those people don't hear sounds or whatever. Yeah, not influenced by that stuff.
Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between matter and mind?
They're different natures, but they influence each other. Okay. In our culture today, I think we've gotten overly we function too much paying attention to material things. You know, and we're out of touch with the mental things which are without form and which are actually more important. And, you know, like the experience of happiness. Yeah. Is happiness atomic in nature? It isn't, you know. You might be able to say, oh, when somebody's happy, certain areas of the brain are emitting dopamine or serotonin or something. But those are chemicals. Those aren't human experience. Yeah, human experience is not atomic in nature. Okay? When our gross, you know, levels of mind are functioning, mind and body influence each other. But, yeah, when you really understand the mind well, you know, you see that there's a whole lot of other dimensions of mind that are not related to our sense faculties and external objects. Yeah. But we're so hooked and addicted to our sense faculties, yeah, that we're always looking at the outside world. And His Holiness always says the real laboratory is inside here. You know, what are we thinking and feeling? How does our mind operate? Yeah. And very seldom do people stop and watch. And very seldom do people learn the tools about how to subdue the disturbing attitudes and how to develop the good ones. And this is what spiritual practice is about. Okay? And it's important because it's the mind that experiences happiness. It's not the body. Without the presence of consciousness, the body doesn't experience anything. It's a dead corpse. Yeah, okay. So since everything is dependent on something else, what does the mind depend on? Yeah, in terms of causal dependence, the mind depends on the preceding moment of mind. Okay, so, you know, our mind of today depends on the mind of yesterday and the mind of the day before and continually going back without a beginning and going forward without an end. Yeah. So the continuity of the mind is beginningless and endless. The continuity of the afflictive emotions, the wrong views, they have no beginning, but they have an end. Because there's the antidote of wisdom that can be applied that can cut their continuity.
Could you say something about the relationship between mind and consciousness and the content?
Oh, I'm using mind and consciousness kind of synonymously here. Yeah. The content of consciousness, you know, you mean the objects that we're perceiving? Or what do you mean by that?
Yeah, objects or mental states or the whole progression of what you're experiencing. It seems like the brain kind of presents the mind with experiences.
But in the gross states, they interrelate. But it's not all coming from the brain. Yeah, it's not all coming from the brain. It comes from many, many different causes and conditions. Okay? We perceive an object. Yeah, so both the brain and the mind are operable together. But we perceive that object and then it reminds us of something else. Yeah, is that memory material?
In some sense, maybe. I mean, not physically, but it's presenting itself from somewhere.
I mean, can you touch it? Is it made of atoms and molecules? A memory?
Well, maybe it's not.
You know? When you imagine something, if I say right now, remember what your mother looked like. Yeah? Your mother's not here. You remember what she looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah? But that memory, that image in your mind isn't material in nature. And it's not made of chemicals. It's, you know, it's experience, it's consciousness. Yeah. I think we've gotten in our culture so much into scientific reductionism that we attribute everything to material things or chemical things. And I think in doing so, we really limit ourselves. And so there's a group of scientists now. His Holiness has been meeting with various scientists for over 30 years. And there's a group now called Mind and Life. And then there's the Emory Tibet Initiative with Science and Buddhism and Dialogue. And going into some of these questions. And you can really start to see there's a difference between the brain and the mind. Because, okay, at one of these Mind and Life conferences, one that happened, actually it was the one, must have been in 89, it was the year His Holiness won the Nobel Peace Prize. And there was there were a couple of scientists at the dialogue. I happened to be there. And a couple of them were scientific reductionists. You know, there's only the brain, only the brain. And so some of the Buddhists, at the end of the day, we were talking, you know, with each other and thinking, you know, when he goes home and he says to his wife, you know, I love you, is she, you know, or if she says to him, I love you, is he going to say, okay, wait a minute, before I believe you, I want your galvanic skin response, I want an EEG, I want, you know, I need some proof. What's your serotonin level? You know, which part of your brain is lighting up? And if it's all that, then I'll believe that you love me. Yeah? Can you imagine? I don't think he does that with his family. Yeah? I asked one scientist during another of the Mind and Life conferences, and because he was doing a lot of research on, you know, the neuroplasticity and, you know, neurological functions. And we were talking about anger. And I said, when you get angry, because he was quite reductionist too, I said, when you get angry, do you think, oh, this is just electrical shocks, electrical things in my brain? Yeah. Do you calm yourself down by saying, oh, it's just electrical blips, you know, the synapses in my brain doing that, or the chemical things going on in the synapses in my brain? Yeah. He said, no. Yeah. When you're angry, you know, is the solution to change what's the synapses of your brain? Are those the things? Is that anger? If you had a Petri dish with brain cells in it and you replicated the chemical electrical thing that was going on when somebody's angry, is that anger? Is that love? Are you in love with somebody's brain? Yeah? Those gray curves are so wonderful. You know, the ripples of this, you know, of the, you know, your hippocampus, your, you know. Nobody thinks like that, yeah? Okay? So I think so often, you know, we just attribute things, you know, and again, this, oh, you know, I have certain genes, therefore this is going to happen to me, you know. I think, you know, this thing, if, oh, I have a genetic predisposition towards alcoholism. I think thinking like that can be really dangerous for people. Yeah? Because you say that to yourself, and then you go down that path. But is alcoholism the brain? Yeah. The brain may be involved, but it's not the brain. Okay? So I think there's a lot of things in this universe that are quite important, that are not material in nature. And I think we need to explore those more. Okay, let's sit quietly just for a couple of minutes. I call this digestion meditation. So just sit for just 1 or 2 minutes. Think about what you heard so that you will take it home with you and continue to think. So just as at the beginning we generated a motivation of compassion and care for living beings, at the end let's also generate that, but this time also rejoice at the positive energy, what we call merit, that we accumulated, that we created together as a group, that we generated individually, all the potentials that we created from our present actions. And let's dedicate that for the well-being of each and every living being. So really feel the good energy, positive potential, the merit that we accumulated. And you can even think of it as like a light at the center of your chest that you radiate out to other living beings. And as it touches them, it brings peace in their body and mind and wisdom. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.